Got a question. We think about it. Question is, what kind of God do we want people to see? I guess that's kind of a haunting question for me, because I think we live in a world in which if you're identified as a Christian, that, well, that's exactly what people are doing. They're seeing some version of God lived out right before their eyes. For me, that's an important question. As I said, it's a haunting question, but at the same time, it's such an important thing, and something that I think I reflect upon quite a bit in my own life. But the question again is, what kind of a God do we want them to see? Do you want them to see? Do I want them to see? I think it's interesting to me that Moses repeatedly reminded God that God ought to be concerned about his reputation. Maybe you remember some of those circumstances when Israel had failed and God came along and he just said, you know what, I'm just going to get rid of the whole bunch. I'm going to start all over. I'm just going to quit. Get rid of them. And Moses would say, no, wait a minute. Wait. You have to be concerned, God, about the way people think of you, right? You have to be concerned. What do you want them to think about when they hear your name? Do you want them to say that you brought them out of Egypt only just to demolish, to destroy them? What will they think? And this is a question that I'd like for us to think about today. What kind of an image do we want to create of God? I want to look at Ezekiel chapter 20. Ezekiel chapter 20. We're going to, if you have your Bibles, just turn there if you would. And we're going to look at this and just see what he says about his own concern about, well, God's own concern about what people think of him. If you look at this here, we're going to set the stage, or we set the stage in these first few verses by giving another date and a time. We've seen that before in the book of Ezekiel. And then God says that he's going to speak, and he tells Ezekiel, he calls him son of man. He says, this is what I want you to say. And he reminds them, if you look at verse number 3 there, he reminds them that he's not going to listen to them. God's not going to listen to them, because they have lost that privilege. You may remember in previous chapters we've discussed this, that basically God says, you know, listen, if you don't think that I'm listening to you, that's fine, okay. I just won't pay any attention to you. So don't ask. And yet something happens in this text that I just think it's fascinating. I think it's just utterly fascinating. It just gets repeated all the way through. And we're just going to look at one sample of it, because it, again, it gets repeated. But look at verse number 5 of Ezekiel chapter 20, and it says this. This is what the sovereign Lord says. On the day I chose Israel, I swore with uplifted hand to the descendants of the house of Jacob and revealed myself to them in Egypt. With uplifted hand, I said to them, I am the Lord your God. On that day I swore to them that I would bring them out of Egypt into a land I had searched out for them, a land flowing with milk and honey, the most beautiful of all lands. And I said to them, each of you must get rid of the vile images you have set your eyes on, and do not defile yourselves with the idols of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. It's just a simple reproduction of the old Exodus story. It's the story, I think, it pervades all of the Old Testament scripture. It's the story that defines God's gracious act within the Old Testament. You were in slavery, I brought you out. You were in Egypt, I took you to Israel. I am God, and I took care of you, and this is how I work. That's been my relationship, and you know, you will know that I am God because of this redemptive act that I have performed in your life. It's just story that gets repeated over and over. And consistently, this becomes the response in verse 8, the first part. This becomes the response of God's people Verse 8, but they rebelled against me and would not listen to me. They did not get rid of the vile images that they had set their eyes on, nor did they forsake the idols of Egypt. And it's just, it's such a consistent pattern. Every time God acted, Israel, they just went the other direction. In fact, the New Testament is full of those stories. If you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 10, it's just one story after another. Don't be like Israel, who constantly rebelled against me, and in spite of the fact that I was trying to do for them with that which was redemptive and helpful, they just kept walking away. Second half of verse 8. After telling them that he's a gracious God and reminding them that they had rebelled, look what he says. So I said I would pour out my wrath on them and spend my anger against them in Egypt. I'm gracious. I'm just so gracious to you. You are rebellious. I'm done. That's my loose translation of that. It kind of reminds me of sort of trying to be kind of like being a parent, right? You say it, they don't do it. And so finally you say, okay, I'm finished. That's it. No more ice cream. And I mean, it's like, it's the worst, you know, punishment that you could ever place on them. But then God says something really fascinating in this text, that just in this next verse. And this is where we get the theme from this particular text. If you look at number 9, verse number 9. But for the sake of my name, I did what would keep it from being profaned in the eyes of the nations they lived among, and in whose sight I had revealed myself to the Israelites by bringing them out of Egypt. Therefore I led them out of Egypt and brought them into the desert because of my name. Because of what my name represents, because of who I am, I am going to say, okay, let's give it a try, let's do it over, because my name is somehow linked to these people in a way that that says my goal is to bring them redemption, because my name is somehow associated with this body of people, and they're supposed to walk with me, and they're supposed to be. To walk before me and represent me, and I am not going to destroy you. I'm going to start over. I'm going to do it again. Because of my name. And see, that's the running theme all the way through this text, that God acts in a certain way so that others will be drawn to his name. You see, that's Moses' concern, isn't it? That somehow God would profane his own name. That somehow by being just, that somehow that would destroy an opportunity for God to act, for people to listen. And in fact, when you think about the Exodus story, one of the consistent images is Moses trying to appeal to God to just not give up on them. I mean, you just find it over and over and over again throughout the story that he doesn't want to quit. I mean, it gets rehearsed a little bit in another text in the book of Ezekiel when God says this. He says, you will be consoled, Ezekiel chapter 14, verse 23, you will be consoled when you see their conduct and their actions, for you will know that I have done nothing in it without cause, declares the sovereign Lord. Ezekiel, you're going to watch this stuff happen. And you're going to realize that nothing occurs that I don't do without a purpose. And that purpose is identified repeatedly in the book of Ezekiel as this. And then you will know, say this with me, and then you will know that I am God. You will know that I am the Lord. In fact, that phrase, then you will know, occurs 30 times in the book of Ezekiel, where he is somehow linked to the actions of God. And then he says, I'm doing this because I want you to know that I am the Lord your God. And in fact, that becomes an image that shows up in the book of Exodus. It shows up in the book of 1 Kings. It shows up again in the prophet Joel, and then in the book of Isaiah. But it just keeps on repeating itself over and over again. I'm doing this because I want you to be sure that you know who I am. God never acts without there being some concern that Israel would somehow respond positively. Or in the book of Amos, God says this. He says, you know, I did this, and he names a disaster. And I did this, and he names another disaster. And five times he says this, I did this, and each of those times he follows that story with this statement, but you still did not return to me. I did it, but you didn't come back. I did it, but you didn't come home. But you hear the intention, don't you? I mean, every one of those events, every one of those actions was designed explicitly to try to stimulate Israel to come home, to return. Because God is all, that's what he's concerned about. He's ultimately concerned about his own name. He's ultimately concerned about, see, everything that he does is redemptive. And if you think about it, that carries over. It certainly carries over into the New Testament. Jesus said this, if I be lifted up, a reference to the cross, remember what he says? If I be lifted up, he says what? I will draw all men unto myself. If I'm lifted up, if God elevates me upon the cross, if God performs his ultimate act of redemption, well, then I will, in fact, draw all men to myself, because God is always interested in redemption. And that is the image that God has always created. The whole story is the story of God's name being elevated, being raised, so that what we see is redemptive. So that we see a redemptive God. And so I want to just come back to the question this morning, what is the image that you and I are creating? What's the picture that you and I create in the community around us of the kind of God that we talk about worshiping, or that people see us go to church to worship? What's the image that we have? See, I think it would be true to say that God's people, the people that follow him, are driven by the desire to present a God that is attractive, that is faithful, that is ultimately redemptive. I know that that's our heart's desire. That's what we want. But I wonder, is that ultimately the God that we present? Even with our very best desire efforts, sometimes it's helpful, I think, for us just to kind of step back and say, you know, what's the image that's being portrayed in my life? I think about Bill. Bill was a man in our church several years ago who took his faith so incredibly seriously. I mean, he just was a devoted follower of God, but he believed that there were certain ways that you expressed your faith well. One of them was that he really felt that to be a follower of Jesus, you needed to be a clean-cut person. I don't qualify. But that's what he thought. He really felt that was really ultimately very, very important. So you can't have any men. You can't wear facial hair. Sorry, Dave. That's not good. But for him, no guy should ever have facial hair. That just was you kind of remember some of this. Somebody remember, that's maybe, everybody looking at Joe here? He's messed up. But you know what? I know what he was trying to say. What he was trying to say was that we need to present a good image of what a Jesus follower is all about, right? But, and yet at the same time, I mean, you know, the intention was there. It was really good, but what he created was an image of a God who was incredibly harsh. I think about Julie. I think about her a lot. She had just got married. I performed their wedding for them, and she was ready to make a decision for Jesus. Here's a gal who was just beaming and ready. She wanted to accept that, and I remember just sitting in the room talking to them, and her new husband just said, whoa, hey, that's okay. I mean, it's all right. It's a good idea, but oh, why do it now? I should never have it right in front of my eyes. I'm trying to talk with them about Jesus, and he just said, you know, God is such a God of grace. There's no hurry to do this. And this gal was ready. And I'm saying, whoa, wait a minute. Wait. She's ready to make this decision. She needs to make this decision now. And his response was basically this. Well, you know, don't worry about it. Nobody ultimately ever goes to hell. And I thought, whoa. Is that the image that we want to portray of a God who ultimately doesn't care about our actions? And I don't know that that's the picture that we want to create either. And I thought about this week as I was thinking through some of these things. I've thought of people who sometimes, I think well-intentioned people who honestly and they come across showing God as a legalistic God, as a harsh God, as a God who just is throwing out candy to everybody. And so even if we... The thing that I'm trying to just ask is, what kind of a picture of God am I creating? And I guess by that I'm asking us to ask that of ourselves. What kind of a picture is my life creating of God by the life that I live, by the things that I do and the things that I say? What is the God that I want people to see? I think about Jerry and Marianne. Jerry and Marianne, who were always picking up children, always bringing them to Sunday school. And I think to myself every time I got a picture of them, Jerry's still alive, Marianne has went to be with the Lord, but every time I think about them, I think to myself, there is a God right there being represented, who is a God who has a deep desire for people to come to faith, who cares about people, who cares about children. I think of Dave and Darlene, both of who have passed to be with the Lord. Dave and Darlene on a number of occasions. I mean, I witnessed this as a kid. I saw it. I saw them just kind of go and put a hand around somebody, slip them a $50 bill or, you know, $100 to help them out, some cash somehow to help them get through the tough times. And I knew it was going on. I don't think they tried to do it so that anyone else would see it, but, you know, kids are always kind of around, right? And they see those things. And I watched them be generous to people. And I thought to myself, you know, here's a God right there who is represented as a God who is a generous God, who is a gracious God, who loves people. And I think about Diane. I think about Diane, who started coming to church. She came every single Sunday. She started to come every Sunday. Her family, they weren't churchgoers. She wasn't really. She just kind of started coming. And teenager, 17 years old. I think she was a senior in high school, maybe 18 years old. Her life was a real mess. Bad, terrible home life. Her family didn't. Ultimately, as a result, every time she came to church, her family, she would tell us that they didn't like that she was coming. They didn't like that she was learning about all this Jesus stuff. And the church just tried to encourage her. They were just there. They loved her. And I think about that, and I think, man, there's a God who's redemptive. Here's a God who cares about the everyday experiences of people. But I'm just asking the question, what do we want people to know about God? Because, see, God seems to take his name pretty seriously, right? He wants only the right things associated with his name. I ran across a story this week, quite actually by accident. I don't know how I popped up onto this, but I want you to see the image here. There's a picture here of the Boston Globe. It's actually kind of a fascinating picture, image. But if you notice on the top of it, there's this fellow, and some of you may know about this fellow here. Has a bunch of stuff about a guy named Rockefeller. That name mean anything to anybody?
Oh, yeah.
Rockefeller. But this is a guy who was convicted several years ago of kidnapping his 7-year-old daughter, and you may remember some of the things. So that's why I was surprised that I saw this. I don't know how I got onto it, but this is from 2008. It's like, I don't know how I got it. But anyway, there it is. And 5 pictures on the front page of the Boston Globe. And that says a lot in any newspaper, that you get 5 pictures right on the front page, right? But if you notice down in the lower right-hand corner there, I don't know if you can see down that way, that far, but you got a picture there of candidate Obama. And this is the same page. This same page announces that he's his running mate Joe Biden and so you got this contrast here, Rockefeller and presidential election, right? You've got that going on. Rockefeller, you getting the picture, right? No, you're not getting that.
Double standard.
The importance of how important a name is. The importance of how that's not, by the way, that's not Clark Rockefeller. His real name is Christian Carl Gehrschreiter. Something like that.
Yeah.
AKA a half a dozen other names and aliases. He calls himself Clark Rockefeller. And buried in this news story, if you read through this news story, is this comment. Here's what it said. Think of all the questions that arise. That's what I did. I Googled what's in a name, and this popped up. That's how I got it. Think of all the questions that arise when we use the family name Rockefeller, or the proper name Clark Rockefeller. What are we doing? We are calling up a rich set of associations, and we are also claiming provenance, a matriarchal or patriarchal link from the original Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller, to his progeny, his son, John D. Rockefeller Jr., his grandsons, Lawrence, Winthrop, Nelson, David, etc. All these Rockefellers are genetically related to the original Rockefeller and presumably heirs to part of his vast fortune. And then the fourth, the fifth, and sixth generation Rockefellers, they are all part of the Rockefeller family tree with John D. Rockefeller as the trunk. When we use the name Rockefeller, we imagine we are picking out some individual related to the 19th century patriarch, not some German imposter, which is this guy, who may or may not have the same surname. A Wolfgang or a Johann come lately, but is the genuine article. The point? Names matter. Names matter. And whether you like it or not, you and I, whether you like it or not, we wear his name. See, it's really interesting to me. I don't know if it's just Christians that do this or not. The third commandment, do we know what that is? Do not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Everybody says, oh, don't swear, right? You know, take all of that OMG language out of your... That's not bad advice. That's good. I just don't know if that has anything to do with that text. In fact, I went out and I looked for information on taking God's name in vain. And I literally, I mean... Hundreds of sermons. I mean, I didn't bother to read most of them. I just kind of glanced at a few to see what the main topic was. And the main topic or the main summary of all of those were, now be careful what you say. That's true. Every time I have a wedding, so far anyway, I know you can take, you know, analogies can always break down, I understand that, but every time I've had a wedding, I can say that, the same thing happens in every wedding, or the same thing has happened in every wedding. Somebody takes somebody else's name. I mean, you know how it is, right? Some people that you know before they got married, I still think, the one I think of is Deb Bundy. I always think of that. You always think of about of them as from their maiden name, the name that you knew before they got married. You have any people like that? Yeah? And I think of Deb Bundy. She automatically just pops in my head. She'll always be forever Deb Bundy. She's Deb Jones, but now, but she's been, you know, got married, but she'll always be Deb Bundy. You know how that is, right? We still know them by the name that they had before. And yet everyone else that comes into in the future who gets to know them and meets them and gets to know them, it becomes Mrs. Jones. It's not no longer Deb Bunting. It's Deb Jones. It's Mrs. So-and-so. The wife takes her husband's name. But the question is, the only question is this, has she taken his name in vain? See, the word simply means to be empty. It means to be devoid of significance, to be without meaning. The question is, will she represent him well with his name? You see, the fascinating thing about this idea of taking the Lord's name in vain, Well, one man said it this way. He said, it's to suck the meaning out of something. And so here's the question. When people know that we wear the name Christian, that we wear the name Jesus follower, that we wear the name we belong to God, the question is, do we put meaning into that or do we suck the meaning out of that? Well, what's the image that is created of people if you and I bear his name? And names mean something. If I were to throw out the name Richard Nixon, everybody has a particular image in their mind, don't they? There are certain things that we come to think about, that we come to associate with when that, you know, we think of certain events, we think of certain things that took place. Maybe you can grab another name from a different era. You could throw out Adolf Hitler. I mean, not that those two names have anything in common, or that they belong in the same sense, but the point is that names mean something. And the question is, what does what we say about God mean? You've heard this advertised on quite convinced on many occasions. If you pay any attention at all out there on the radio or you're on the computer, or, they say before you call a plumber, you need to check Angie's List. How many of you have seen that? Angie's List. Somebody named Angie got smart enough to put recommendations out there on the internet. Before you call a body shop, check Angie's List. Before you go to a realtor, you need to check Angie's List. Or before you try a church, you check Angie's List. And see, what they're saying is, she, by her assessment, will determine whether or not you ought to use that service. Her compliment or her criticism is going to dictate the reputation of that particular name. And I don't know if this is true or not. I mean, I keep reading this. I can't find any statistic out there to actually verify this, but they say that in the business world, seven compliments have to be made to undo one negative compliment. If you had bad service at any particular place of business, and you tell that to one person, it takes seven other people saying something positive to overcome that one negative. And that one unhappy customer who tells seven other people represents 50 customers, well, 49 to be exact, who are telling other, who are talking to other people. And you start doing the math and you can see how that just kind of, I don't know if that's true or not, I really don't. But I think you get the point. And the point is, if what we represent for God is negative, it doesn't take long for that to prove. And then it takes at least seven people, maybe more, painting a positive picture of God to undo the one negative picture. And the point is, your name matters. Four times in this text, we go through the same thing. We have grace and rebellion and anger. My name. And then it's grace and rebellion and anger and my name. And then it's grace and rebellion and anger and my name. And then the fourth time, though, there's this little shift there. And it says grace and rebellion and anger and I'm done. And if you stop reading at the end of that paragraph, you just kind of come to the conclusion that he's done. God has just had it. He has finished. There is no more extension. There's no more protecting his name. There's no more anything because he's just had it. He is finished. He's done. But if you just keep reading down in the text, if you just keep following all the way down to the end of chapter 20, you get toward the end, and here's what he says in verse number 39. Take a look at this. He says, as for you, O house of Israel, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Go and serve your idol. Listen to the sarcasm that he uses in this statement. Go and serve your idols, every one of you. But afterward, you will surely listen to me and no longer profane my holy name with your gifts and idols. For on my holy mountain, the high mountain of Israel, declares the sovereign Lord, there in the land of the entire house of Israel will serve me. And there I will accept them. There I will require your offerings and your choice gifts along with all your holy sacrifices. I will accept you as a fragrant incense when I bring you out from the nations and gather you from the countries where you have been scattered. And I will show myself holy among you in the sight of the nations. Then you will know that I am the Lord when I bring you into the house or into the land of Israel, the land I have sworn with uplifted hand to give to your fathers. There you will remember your conduct and all the actions by which you have defiled yourselves, and you will loathe yourself for all the evil you have done. You will know that I am the Lord when I deal with you for my name's sake, and not according to your evil ways and your corrupt practices, O house of Israel, or house of Israel, declares the sovereign Lord. There's coming a day, he says, when yes, you will realize how bad you have done. But that's okay. Because I'm going to deal with you in grace. And I'm going to draw you out of exile. And I'm going to present you to myself a holy people. And there he says, you will know me and you will honor my name. He's done that. Right? He has drawn us out of exile. And he has brought us from our own personal bondages of Egypt. And he has brought his people together at a mountain. It is called Calvary. And there, under the cross of Christ, he calls us. He called us to reject the ways that we used to live and to honor him with our choice to follow him. And every week we come to the table. And every week we are reminded that his name has meaning, his name has value, that he brought redemption to us. So we come and eat and drink in Jesus' name as a memory. But we also come and eat and drink in his name as a commitment that we will go out into the world and we will paint a picture of who God is that's attractive, welcoming. It shows a picture of God as a very redemptive God who cares. So we invite you to come to eat. And as you do, you come and eat. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for welcoming us to this table. Father, we come here and we eat in Jesus' name. And we leave this table committed to live for Jesus. That your name might be lifted up and made holy.